Thanks for the introduction, Judith, and thanks. It's really a pleasure to see so many people show up for this panel here. We are really excited that people are so interested in positive affirmative models of sexual health, and so I know that I'm speaking on behalf of the panel, but I think we're all very excited that you're here. In particular, I think it's a challenge to talk about positive messages when it comes to sexual assault prevention education as well. Prior to getting my PhD, I was working on a sexual assault prevention education program, and so this is something that I've worked with and struggled with. And so my co-presenter, Dr. Sonia Statinsky at University of Kansas, we've talked a lot about this, and so we're going to be talking to you, or I'm going to be talking to you on behalf of the two of us, about different ways in which we can sort of promote positive culture when it comes to conceptualizing sexual consent and sexual assault prevention education. And we do not have any personal financial relationships to disclose. So part of the reason that sexual assault prevention education is so important is that sexual assault remains such a salient public health issue. We know that about 15 to 38% of women will be sexually assaulted during their lifetime. We know that about 83 to 90% of those victims will be known, those perpetrators will be known to the victim prior to the assault. And we know that college women are at increased risk for not only experiencing sexual assault, but also for experiencing repeat victimization. During the presentation, or the way in which we've, Sonia and I sort of conceptualized this talk, we'll focus on primarily females as victims, males as perpetrators, and that's not to say that other types of sexual assault does not occur, and that's not to say that those roles can be different. However, within the college environment, we do know that over 95% of sexual assaults occur with a female victim and male perpetrator. So we'll be sort of talking about it in that framework. That's, again, not to acknowledge or not to say that other situations do not occur. So we know that sexual assault's common, and we know that it continues to be a health issue. Campuses across the United States have implemented different initiatives to combat high rates of sexual assault, in part because they've been mandated in order to receive federal funds. They need to implement some sort of sexual assault prevention education initiative. The extent to which these initiatives are implemented and are monitored varies based on institution. They can look at things like freshman orientation, in which sexual assault prevention education is introduced as part of the freshman orientation. It can be through sort of spotty programs that are part of health courses or through health center initiatives, or it can be something more formalized where it's an online sexual assault prevention education program in which all university students are required to experience prior to registering for classes. So it can look very different. The mandate says that it needs to be done, and it doesn't to some extent dictate how it should be done or regulate the extent to which it is done. And we know that when we look at peer-reviewed literature, there's sort of a lack of comprehensive data assessing the effectiveness of some programs. So some studies will demonstrate success in terms of reducing things like rape myths, in terms of reducing reported sexually assaultive behaviors. Other programs will demonstrate success at initial post-test. Other times at 6-month or 12-month post-test, those attitude shifts typically may not remain. So the extent to which sexual assault prevention education right now, or current sexual assault prevention education programs, their success sort of varies based on what type of program we're looking at and what the ultimate outcome variables are that are being assessed and the time in which they're being assessed. Regardless of the type of program that that's being implemented, we sort of see these common themes or assumptions emerge within sexual assault prevention education. And it may be that these things are implicit or explicitly stated as part of the sexual assault prevention education programs. So things like women being the primary targets, again, this might be something that's explicit, programs that are geared specifically toward women, or it might be implicit in the language that's used in part of the programming. And that's really aimed at women. We see women being conceptualized as gatekeepers. And so the individuals, women are, the onus is on women to say no as being the gatekeeper. And we also see that in part, empirical research, you know, demonstrates that women are responsible for saying no because men are assumed to always be saying yes, and so that typically falls in line with the traditional sexual script, which we see college students still endorsing this idea that women are gatekeepers and men are sexual initiators. We also see in many different facets that women are sort of responsible for knowing what to do to prevent the assault. And so we see this in different ways, different tips and information that's provided as part of sexual assault prevention education, things like women need to watch how much they have to drink, they need to explicitly, you know, state their no or their refusals to engage in sex, they need to travel in pairs and buddies and watch out for each other. And, you know, Sonia and I are not when we talk about these assumptions, we're not saying that this is bad advice or bad tips. We're certainly not saying that this is problematic in providing this information to women. But when we see this information provided in this way, it leads us to certain assumptions about sexual encounters and sexual relationships between men and women. Additionally, within sexual assault prevention education, individual behaviors tend to be privileged over examining the contextualized environment. So again, that looks like telling individuals to obtain consent, to say no, to watch how much they have to drink, and it's addressing these pointed behaviors rather than addressing larger cultural issues within the college environment, which can contribute to the occurrence of sexual assault. And a lot of sexual assault prevention education programming, including the one that I used to run, really hinged on this idea of consent promotion. So get consent in the context, get explicit verbal consent in the context of the sexual dyad. And this type of education may not be relevant to men, as research suggests that men both indicate consent, communicate their consent, as well as interpret consent through nonverbal cues. So telling men to obtain explicit consent might not seem relevant to them. It also does not address the situational, contextual, and relational factors that impact consent, so things like the type of relationship or the environment in which a sexual activity might be engaging in. Particularly when we think about those 83 to 90% of victims who are perpetrators who are known to the victim prior to the assault, the idea is that there's some level of acquaintance or relationship there between victim and perpetrator, and as a result, there's often some element of trust involved. So that complicates these issues. And lastly, it doesn't take into account the gender inequity in American college culture, which Armstrong et al. Has really discussed in terms of the party rape culture that occurs on college campuses, which dictate gender inequity in the party environment, which can contribute to sexual assault. There's also several sort of sex-negative assumptions targeted at men within sexual assault prevention education programming. We see, as I've sort of been discussing already, the reinforcement of the traditional sexual script and heterosexual male sexuality. So within the college environment, we see sexual activities targeted at men or framed for men as sexual conquests. The ultimate goal for men in terms of their socializing is to obtain sex, and it's something that is sort of reinforced to men. We also see men's pleasure being privileged, their sexual needs and privileges, and pleasure being privileged over women, and again, men being aimed being framed as the sexual initiators, which then results in women being the sexual gatekeepers. And also the idea of post-refusal sexual persistence, the idea that women need to constantly be saying no, assumes that men then can continue to pursue even when a woman is refusing, and this sort of normalizes a very limited perspective on male sexuality. So what Sonia and I, you know, have, in examining the literature, have proposed alternative, more sex-positive models for sexual assault prevention education. We recognize the challenge in doing this. We've sort of narrowed it down to four components that we think sexual assault prevention education should focus attention on. First being enthusiastic consent, and this is not a novel idea. Sort of feminist models of consent have promoted this enthusiastic and active yes to be obtained rather than the sort of traditional conceptualization of no means no, the idea that yes means yes and both parties should be enthusiastically saying yes to sexual encounters. We also think that promoting positive sexual experiences should be the goal, so that That makes sense. If we have partners who are invested in each other's pleasure, they'll be more likely to engage in consensual experiences. If there's no investment in what my partner is experiencing in terms of a pleasurable event, then it's sort of irrelevant whether or not they want to be doing it to some extent. And we've seen that in some of the in some of my own research. Also, addressing the rape culture within college environment is extremely important. Deconstructing the sort of social environment has been shown to be more effective than these targeted, pointed, behavioral focused interventions. And so addressing the larger institutional acceptance of sexual assault within the college environment has been shown to be more effective than just focusing on various behaviors that are aimed at reducing things like rape myths. And lastly, giving women sexual agency is something that we think is really important. Allowing women to be able to say yes to sex and not have those fear of those negative labels, which, you know, we would hope at this point we've bypassed, but to some extent within the college environment we really haven't. We're still seeing women who want to engage in sex and who are interested in engaging in sex, still negative labels will sometimes apply. And so allowing women to engage in sexual activities without fearing this is would also give them the freedom to say no and have that no respected when they can actually say yes and don't have to fear being coy or saying no initially to avoid appearing in a particular way. So we think that there's several possible benefits to promoting sex-positive sexual assault prevention education. First of all, deconstructing rape myths could provide a more holistic approach to sexual assault prevention education for both men and women. I've talked quite a bit about the traditional sexual scripts and rigid sexual roles for men and women, and so we can have opportunities where women act as sexual initiators and men are choosing to say no, as traditionally men's masculinity has been tied to saying yes, and that is seen in the assumptions that men should be saying yes. And so having opportunity for men to choose to say no if they want to, as well as women act as initiators. And this can reduce the tight grip of sexual scripts that state that women are not interested in sex, because I think that we probably all agree in this room that that's not the case. And women, if they can express their sexuality in an honest, authentic way, it provides an opportunity for both individuals to have pleasurable experiences as well as break some of these rigid scripts. And active consent can also improve the quality and satisfaction of both experiences, as some preliminary research suggests that as people feel like the event is more agreed to and more wanted, they tend to have a higher quality experience during that event. So lastly, to conclude here, some future directions where Sonia and I think this should go. We really need to address, examine empirically if these proposed sex-positive models will have the suggested effect that we're hoping that they would. We need to integrate this within current traditional frameworks of sexual assault prevention education that address both miscommunication within the dyad as well as the rape supportive culture that I've been speaking about. And we also see that other health-related interventions address multi-level approaches at both the interpersonal, interpersonal, and even community and cultural level, and we think that that framework should also be applied to sexual assault prevention education. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and attention and see if there's time for questions, if anyone has any questions.
Are there one or two questions on this presentation? Yes, John.
So you're asking if I can comment on how abstinence only ties into this type of approach. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's something that I think Sonia and I talk quite a bit about, something I talk a lot about in classes that I teach about sexual violence. So we see things like abstinence-only sex education, not just the initiatives that happen in the classroom, but the larger culture, like the virginity balls and these sorts of initiatives where we're preserving women's sexuality as something that is, I mean, it's essentially a woman's value is tied to her virginity. And so if she is going to say yes, then that decreases her value, and therefore we're essentially commodifying sex and saying that women, you know, if women want to say, it makes it more difficult for women to say yes, and therefore we get into issues of token resistance where women are saying no, although we know that that's often rare, that women say no when they mean yes, but the idea that women need to play coy can manifest itself. We also have situations in abstinence only where, you know, you're talking about man-woman sex only, and so if, and that sort of privileges male heterosexuality, and so if men don't want to say no for many reasons, maybe, you know, they don't want to have sex with women, or just because they don't want to have sex with this particular woman at this particular time, it's seen that they're not supposed to and they're not allowed to, and so it really reinforces the rigid gender roles that Sonia and I think are important to dispel.